Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, the 29th of September, 1999. We are in the Village Center this morning, continuing with the Lens Conference, as Dr. Ted Peters presents Genetic Determinism and Human Freedom. The session number is Lens 99-6. Let's listen in.
Well, good morning. Our theme for the week has to do with change and time and the future. And quite relevant for this is the interaction between natural science and theology and ethics and, in some cases, even public policy. So if you've outlines that we passed out yesterday, you'll see the topics for today and tomorrow. Today is Genetic Determinism and Human Freedom, Theological Response. And what I'd like to do is to take a look at the frontier of genetic research, at least over the last couple of years, and a couple of issues, one of which has become quite significant in the press, the cloning controversy, and then the current issue, alive perhaps for a year, but not quite so publicly known, the stem cell controversy, and the awesome implications that this will have for understanding human nature and the human future. And then to take a look at the question, the philosophical question of determinism, and see just what kind of implications that might have for our understanding of human nature, human freedom, and those kinds of things. And challenge us to think about these things. This is not a bad thing, this is a good thing. In many ways, it's an exciting time to be alive. And again, I want to say that the things we're going to talk about are not nailed down and final. This is something that's fluid and changing, and nobody has a patent on the right way to think about this stuff. We're kind of in the middle of it. I'm going to use slides virtually for my entire talk, and I'm concerned here a little bit. I don't know, Catherine, do you have eyes in the back of your head? Sometimes she does, all right. But you might want to situate yourself so it's kind of easy to look. Maybe you can turn to the benches. We'll give you a moment. Oops, I don't. That's right.
You want to tell people there's chairs back here?
Well, they've got it all the way around. Okay.
There are chairs to my right and back over here for those who would need to resituate yourself.
You won't see a bear behind, but you will see a bear.
Right. Just a personal note before we turn on the first slide. I teach at our Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, California, which is part of the Graduate Theological Union. And within the Graduate Theological Union, we have a number of research centers. One of these is called the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences, and that's the one with the address and the email number on your handout, your outline. And you can see the bridge there, that's the Golden Gate Bridge. While it was in the process of construction, we really see our mission as constructing bridges between the hard sciences and theological reflection. And we're primarily Christian, but we also try to do this for distinctive religious traditions. We have a major project with Islamic thought going on here currently. We want to deal with issues such as God and the world, God and creation, and the understanding of nature apprehended through natural science. These are the kinds of things that occupy our time and energy. All right, let's try the first slide, and maybe we can dim the lights. As you know, one of the This is the dark side of God. Well, I'll introduce the first slide while we're getting it ready. A number of you have actually come up to me and said, you know, really, that, we can leave that fishy thing on there. A number of you actually have approached me and said, you know, a really important concern that we need to deal with in the church is the theory of evolution, and especially as it relates to the Christian doctrine of creation and what's going on in our society. I just want to say yes. I also want to say that's a hard one. What we do at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences, for the most part, is deal with the privileged discussions within Darwinian theory about the question of whether or not there really is purpose and direction in evolutionary development. You're probably aware that most Darwinians and neo-Darwinians deny that there is any purpose, and that's a lot of fun. But the public discussion is of a very different nature. That really has to do with creationism versus what goes on in evolutionary theory. It also has to do with conservative Christians attacking liberal Protestants because liberal Protestants seem to be evolutionary theists. That second one is a much tougher nut to crack. It does deserve some responsible attention. Maybe we'll get to it. At any rate, I like this story of the history of the human race. We start as a fish and we end up doing fishing. Is that God's purpose for us, I wonder? Next slide. Now, in Berkeley, when we have ideological struggles, they take place on the backs of cars. And as you probably are aware, this is an ichthus, Christian symbol, and the word ichthus is really an acrostic for iota, kappa, theta, upsilon, and sigma, Jesus Christ, God's Son, and our Savior. Many of these can be found on the backs of cars in Berkeley and probably your community as well. Next slide. But the Darwinists are not to be outdone. And so here we have a fish with little legs that is, of course, going to climb onto land and become what we know of as life, right? But the Christians have to counterattack. Let's try the next slide. And so this is quite self-explanatory. I went into the parking lot of Evangelical Church to snap these pictures, and they want to know, what is he doing out there? Next slide. Next one. Well, let me take up the cloning controversy, and the cloning controversy belongs within a much larger development that's began in 1987. A worldwide program to try to sequence the nucleotides in the human DNA to locate all of the genes in human DNA, find out what they do, and then the third goal of the Human Genome Initiative has been to find those genes that contribute to human disease. 4,000 to 6,000 human diseases are directly the result of malfunctioning genes. And to identify these genes and then to come up with therapies that would be able to deal with them. Francis Collins, if you've seen my book, Playing God in the Bookstore, who wrote the foreword, there is a geneticist who discovered the gene for cystic fibrosis in 1992. And there's no cure for it, but at least they have the knowledge of what causes cystic fibrosis, and they're working night and day on trying to come up with some kind of genetic-based therapy to deal with that. Of course, the easy thing would be for future generations to simply eliminate the gene so that people will not be born with it, but it would also be nice if we could come up with a somatic therapy somehow or other to handle or to provide some kind of relief for those who are suffering from cystic fibrosis. So these are the three main goals of the Human Genome Project, to sequence the nucleotides in the DNA, of which there are about 3 billion base pairs, to identify the genes. Most of the official estimates have been 80 to 100,000 genes in each one of us. But I just read last week where a geneticist in Palo Alto in California says he's quite sure there are 140,000 genes. We've probably mapped somewhere in the 30 to 40,000 range at this particular point. So the Human Genome Project is well underway. And it's thought that within a year or two, we'll have the first comprehensive maps of the human genome. Within that much larger project, then we've had a couple of controversies of rather significant proportion. One is the cloning controversy, and let's try the next slide. And let me just remind you of the history of this. This is a picture of Ian Wilmot at the Roslin Center, Research Center in Scotland. And on February 22nd, 1997, he had a press conference in which he announced the cloning of Dolly. Now let me just back up and say something about the scientific achievement of Wilmot. It's not that he produced two sheep with the same genetic code. That kind of thing has been done for a long time with sheep and with cattle, simply by splitting embryos. If you split an embryo and the two of them divide separately, you get twins, or you can do it with quadruplets. So the creation of two animals with the same genetic code is not new. But how he did it was what was important for understanding the way genes work. He started with a cell taken from the mammary gland of a 7-year-old sheep. Now, what's important about the DNA in that cell is that it's already differentiated. When we are only an egg fertilized by a sperm, and we now have 46 chromosomes in that egg, the DNA is undifferentiated. It is totipotent. That is to say, it can produce any tissue in the body anywhere. As time goes, each cell becomes more and more differentiated, and you turn on some genes and keep others off. For example, right now, the genes in the end of my finger are being activated to produce fingernails, and the genes in the cells in my hair follicles are turned on to produce hair, and the genes for fingernails are turned off. It's kind of convenient that way. When I go to Cindy the barber, I ask her to please cut the hairs out of my nose and ears because somehow or other the wrong genes got turned on there. So our cells as mature adults are all differentiated so that some genes are turned on and all the other ones are turned off. So now what Ian Wilmot has done is start with cells that are 7 years old that are producing only one kind of tissue, mammary gland tissue. Then he takes an oocyte, that is to say, an egg from another sheep, and he removes the nucleus. He removes the 23 chromosomes, and then, wait a minute, did he do that? Yeah, he did, he did. He removed the nucleus, so now he's got the egg and only the cytoplasm in it. So he takes this egg with no chromosomes, and he takes this 7-year-old cell, which, by the way, he has starved of nutrients. And so this cell has gone into a kind of state of hibernation. And the DNA is quiet. That is to say, it's not developing. It's not dividing. He puts these two together and hits them with a jolt of electricity. And the oocyte, the egg, absorbs the cell with the sleeping DNA. He hits it with a second shot of electricity, and that DNA wakes up. It comes out of its hibernation and it begins to divide, but now as it begins to divide, it is undifferentiated. That is to say, he now has an embryo. That's the scientific achievement. that you could start with an already differentiated nucleus in a cell, run it back to its pre-differentiated state, and create an embryo. That's the nature of the achievement. The fact that Dolly has the same genetic code as that seven-year-old sheep is interesting, but that's not the achievement. Now, a fair question, and at this particular meeting at the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington, which took place in June of 1997, I had lunch with Ian Wilmut that day, and I asked him, I said, how old is Dolly? Is she seven, or is she just, you know, an infant? And he said, I don't know. Well, this past spring, we put that to the test, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit. Now, another thing culturally that's significant is that this is in the auditorium of the American Association for the Advancement of Science to discuss the significance of cloning. And we had three theologians on the panel. This is in the halls of science, and we had three theologians on the panel. Why? Well, because the world saw this as intrinsically a religious issue. It's not just science. This is religious in some way or another. Now, let's try the next slide. This is the journal Nature, in which the study of cloning came out. And note the date on it. It's... Can't make my laser work here. There we are. There's the date. Is it February 27? That's 5 days after Ian Wilmut's public announcement. Is Ian Wilmut a kind of a shy person that doesn't want the world to know what he's doing? No way. Ian Wilmut announces that he has cloned Dolly. Within hours, I don't know, maybe 12 hours or something like that, the Church of Scotland comes out with a long press release denouncing human cloning. Has any human cloning taken place? No. Does Ian Wilmut have any plans for cloning human beings? No. Does Ian Wilmut favor cloning human beings? No. But the Church of Scotland has now denounced human cloning. And the Church of Scotland argues that we should not clone human beings for a number of reasons. One, it will reduce human diversity, human genetic diversity, and that God favors human diversity. And so we would be violating God's will if we were to clone human beings and reduce diversity. Now, I don't know where he got that from Scripture, or where the Church of Scotland got it from Scripture, but suddenly it is a violation of God's will to violate the diversity principle. Secondly, there was a fear expressed in this original press release that human dignity would be compromised if people were brought into the world being cloned, because they would have the same genetic code as another person. And two people with the same genetic code would violate individuality and identity and dignity. Well, those arguments were picked up and they went all over the world, lickety-split, and it didn't matter whether you were conservative or liberal. The Christian Century, which is a knee-jerk liberal magazine, and Christianity Today, which does the same thing for the evangelicals, both came out with editorials opposed to human cloning and for basically the same reasons. By March 6, you have statements from both the Southern Baptist Convention, which is conservative, the United Methodist Church, which is on the liberal side, condemning human cloning. It seems to me that as and I don't watch the media very often, but I did in these days and became a part of it, that the media interviewed more philosophers, theologians, and ethicists than it did scientists about this particular topic. What I think was going on is what I call the religious yuck factor. There's something about cloning that makes us go, yuck. It's my belief that Christian ethics and public policy ought not to be founded on yuck, but something a little bit more careful and a little bit more discerning. I have to report on the trail from Heart Lake yesterday. I was walking with Glenn Peterson, and he was telling the story of how he walked down the hall and saw his wife in the kitchen, and she had Nestle's Quick out. And she had a spoon in it, and she was spooning the Nestle's Quick directly from the container into her mouth. And Glenn said this upset him. And so he walked in and started scolding her for doing this. And she says, well, just what's the problem with this? And he says, well, it's strange. Well, I think that that religious yuck is, this is strange. And it takes a little while to work through the strangeness in order to think about a little bit more clearly what might be going on. Next slide. This is Science magazine, and look at Dolly in the front and all of her progeny. Next slide. This is the New Yorker. Thank goodness we got a lot of humor out of cloning with all those multiple Einsteins. Next slide. Will there ever be another you? Read EWE. Well, President Clinton called a news conference in the White House, and I'm trying to remember the date. I think it might have been around March 6 or March 8. And he cut off all government funding for experiments in human cloning. How much human cloning was going on? None. But he cut off the money for it. And he asked for a 90-day moratorium against it. And in the meantime, he asked his National Bioethics Advisory Commission to investigate. And I just, I guess, want to say this is one time where the government worked. The NBAC was in session and holding hearings in Washington by March 16 and 17. Note, that's less than a month after the original press conference. And they included interviews with theologians and religious leaders from conservative Christian Protestants, liberal Protestants, Roman Catholics, Muslims, Hindus, Jews, and Buddhists. And for the most part, these religious leaders were opposed to human cloning, and very much for the same kinds of arguments, namely that human identity, human individuality might be threatened, and indirectly then human dignity. In April of that year, there were hearings held at the state legislature in California. California is the only state to date to pass a law against human cloning. And in those hearings, there was a doctor from San Francisco whose name I've conveniently forgotten, who testified that he wanted to have a strictly secular, strictly non-religious argument against the cloning of human beings. And his argument was that it would violate, that having two people with the same genetic code would violate human individuality and human identity, and that we ought to have a law that would prohibit two people from having the same genetic code. He did. Note two things about this. Number one is he called it a secular, non-religious argument, but it's the same one you got from the Church of Scotland, which is a religious group. And then secondly, if we were to pass a law saying that no two people could have the same genome, that what would you do about identical twins? Would one of them have to go to jail and the other one stay out? We've had experiences over a long period of time with multiple people with the same genetic codes. And as they grow up, even if their mothers and fathers dress them alike, they have their own interiority, they gain their own sense of identity, and certainly when they go to vote, they each get a separate vote. And so our experience with identical twins gives us something to go on with regard to the possible implications of this. These kinds of things were clarified then when the National Bioethics Advisory Commission came out with its report in June of 1997. Be that as it may, there was a tremendous religious yuck factor and secular yuck factor that put pressure on the federal government, federal legislature to pass laws against it. President Clinton introduced a bill and it just died in committee. Actually, I suppose it's hibernating in committee currently in Washington. No significant laws have been passed with regard to cloning. And I, for one, actually am happy with that. Even though I do agree with the one part of the proposal of President Clinton, and that was to have a moratorium against experiments in human cloning. I really do think that this is something we do not need to do in the near future and probably ought not to do, not because of religious yuck, but because the cloning as a technology is likely to get added to the existing exotic reproductive technologies that we have, and that there's some risk that children of the future are going to become commodified. And I think the commodification of children is a general danger in our society. It's not peculiar to cloning. It has to do with expanding genetic services and reproduction in general. And that our task as a church and as a culture is to lift up human dignity and to remind ourselves that each child is precious regardless of his or her genetic code, and it doesn't matter whether they came from a clone, from artificial insemination, or from the old-fashioned way. 1 John 4:17 is favorite verse for a lot of people. We love because God first loved us. I want a new version of that. God loves each one of us regardless of our genetic code, and we ought to do likewise. And despite all the wondrous things that the new genetics can do, our concern finally is going to be equality before the cross, and maybe even a special concern for the marginalized new babies, perfect babies, start coming online who have been genetically designed. Maybe we're going to have to give priority to children born the old-fashioned way who still might get stuck with a gene for cystic fibrosis or what have you. Let's try the next slide. Time magazine is a great place for theology. Is it against God's will to clone human beings? Yes, it is. There it is, in print. Next slide. Can souls be Xeroxed? I had never thought about this question before, and after I thought about it, my answer is no, I don't think so. It depends a little bit on what you think a soul is. If you agree with Pope John Paul II, that at conception there are three factors, the mommy, the daddy, and God, and that God creates and implants a soul at that particular moment, so that you're really talking about the soul as a metaphysical entity that belongs to the individual. That would be one way of thinking about it. And maybe if you have that metaphysical understanding of the soul, perhaps cloning would be a threat. I tend to think of the soul much more in terms of identifying that relationship that we have with God. It's that dimension of our being that overlaps with that which transcends us. And the really important things about the soul, our relationship with God, the fulfillment in this life, the call to resurrection and new creation, those things finally are God's responsibility in this relationship that we have. And because God is responsible, at least in part, for our souls, I just do not see that the status of our souls is going to be threatened by this kind of technology or any other one. Next slide. Now, this is my favorite example of religious yuck. Here is Der Spiegel in Germany. We have a whole line of cloned Hitlers, a line of cloned Albert Einsteins, a line of cloned Claudia Schiffers. And note, secular magazine, capital letters, a theological term, Der Sündenfall, the fall into sin. Profound sense of reaction. And again, I want to say, pastorally, we need to attend to religious yuck. That's strange. But at the same time, when it comes to theological deliberation, ethical deliberation, I think we need a more reasoned approach. Next slide. Love the humor. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was slightly gray. It didn't have a father, just some borrowed DNA. It sort of had a mother, though the ovum was on loan. It was not so much a lambkin as a little baby clone. And soon it had a fellow clone, and soon it had some more. They followed her to school one day, all cramming through the door. It made the children laugh and sing. The teachers found it droll. There were too many Lambie clones for Mary to control. No other could control the sheep, since their programs didn't vary. So the scientist resolved it all by cloning Mary. But now they feel quite sheepish, those scientists unwary. One problem solved, but what to do with Mary, Mary, Mary? Next slide. Now let me shift to the stem cell controversy, and chances are this is something that if you see articles about it in the newspaper, you may just pass over for others. It's a little bit more complex. But let me try to give you some background and identify what the public policy issues are, and then provide you some unsolvable problems that you can stay awake late at night trying to think about. The first one has to do, and this is the background, the telomerase theory of aging. And you can see the word telomerase here. If you can look at me for just a second, I'm in the light. If you can imagine, there was no deep meaning to that metaphor. If you can imagine that in my two fingers here, I'm holding a long white thread, and this thread is draped down towards the floor. If you were to take one of the chromosomes out of your DNA and stretch it out and dry it, that's exactly what it would look like, is one of these long white threads. Now just imagine that it's a shoelace. Those of you who are not into Velcro shoes, it's one of those shoelaces. And on the end of this shoelace, there are those little plastic gizmos that you have that you makes it easy to put the shoelace through the eyes of the shoe. Well, on the ends of our chromosomes is a series of nucleotides that makes the chemical telomerase. Now, what the geneticists have recently discovered is that as cells divide, that the number of base pairs of telomerase reduces. So that every time a cell divides, you get less and less telomerase on the ends of your chromosomes. When your cell is divided 40 times, 50 times, 60 times, the telomerase is so weak that it gives way and the chromosome falls apart, and then the genes start floating around at random in the cytoplasm, and the cell goes into a state of senescence, and it won't divide anymore. And when that cell dies, when enough of them die, you and I die. So they developed the telomerase theory of aging. If we could lengthen the telomeres on the end of the chromosomes and keep them healthy, could we extend human life? Well, the theory is yes, to about two or three centuries. And already in the laboratory, the synthetic telomerase has been developed. Already, what has been happening are experiments in order to send genes in that will attach to chromosomes and lengthen and rejuvenate the telomeres. So that's already happening. The flip side of this is that it's too much telomere activity that causes cancer tumors, right? Because the cells keep dividing and dividing and dividing. So the same researchers are now working on a suicide gene. That is to say, to send this gene through a virus vector into tumor cells to lodge in those chromosomes and turn off the telomerase activity. And thereby, when those cells with the cancerous telomerase activity die, then they're not replaced and the tumors will shrink. So that this is the whole area of research then that is standing behind the stem cell controversy. Now, just before we go on, we need to think about this theologically a little bit and coming down the pike, because if therapies can be developed that will actually start lengthening human life by a half century, a century, or perhaps more, and we're just thinking of Glenn and his wife eating the Nestles, this is strange, right? Because we know ritually that the kid gets the car keys at 18, right? And you graduate from college at a certain age, and at 25, you take marriage vows in which you promise your spouse that I'll be yours until death do us part for another 275 years. That the way we conceive of the rhythms of life will need to be rethought. And where do these patterns come from in our tradition? And do they belong only to the tradition? Or will somebody come out and say, but God has willed that we get the car keys at 18, or that we retire at 65, or what have you? How are we going to handle those kinds of things about human purpose, human vocation, meaning in life? And there isn't anybody the world's going to go to first, other than the church and to people who have thought about this religiously. Okay, so that's the background for the stem cell controversy. Now let's complicate a little bit more. Now we're going to have, hopefully, maybe not, but we might have the opportunity to live longer. You got another problem, that our organs wear out and they stop functioning. Heart, liver, pancreas, kidneys, and these kinds of things. Would there be a way to use this kind of technology in order to rejuvenate these particular organs? And not just to create or rejuvenate these organs, but to make them genetically compatible with the person that you're working with. Right now, we have organ transplantation, but if you get a donated heart or some kind of organ, your body may reject. You may reject the incoming organ, and that's because the genetic codes are incompatible. But what would happen if you were to receive an organ in transplantation surgery that has your genetic code? No rejection. Where do we get organs now? Well, from motorcyclists who don't wear helmets, right? And there's a minimum supply of that. And if we could grow organs in the laboratory without having to take them from accidents, it would change things. And so the stem cell controversy comes in. If we could go back and we could get those oocytes such as Ian Wilmot had developed in the sheep Dolly, and when it comes to inserting the DNA in that oocyte, we could insert your DNA or my DNA. so that it would be just exactly the genetic code that we want. And then, and here's the really big trick yet to be done, turn on just the genes for the tissue that we want to rejuvenate: heart tissue, liver, pancreas, kidney, etc. Then we could grow just the tissue that a person needs for transplantation surgery that would lead to the rejuvenation of organs, which would actually permit then a healthy life into old age. And so let's try the next slide. Okay, so this is the background then for the stem cell controversy, which really begins in August of last year. So what, we're 13 months into it? And I'll spare you a lot of the details, but the first significant advance comes from a guy named James Thompson at the University of Wisconsin. And here's what the first task is: to obtain viable stem cells that we can actually use for the purpose of teasing out certain gene expression, create organs. And here's what he did. He took from a reproductive technology clinic fertilized or eggs, frozen. Actually, this is what he gets from the IVF clinic. Already fertilized ova that have been put in a freezer. People who want to have a baby through in vitro fertilization will have, say, 10 eggs of the woman fertilized with the man's sperm in a petri dish, and then perhaps 8 of them will be frozen, and 1, 2, or 3 will be placed in the mother's uterus in order to give birth to a baby. Well, if that first try fails, then they'll go back and they'll thaw out 2 or 3 more and on down the line until finally a pregnancy occurs. Well, if the pregnancy occurs on the first time, you got 6 or 7 or 8 of these still in the freezer. So what the researchers do is they go pull them out of the freezer and they thaw them and they start them developing until they get to this stage here, the blastocyst, which is somewhere from the fourth to the sixth day. And you have this little outer shell which is developed, and that's called the trophectoderm. Now, if this were growing in a mother's womb, that trophectoderm would eventually develop a placenta, and then it would adhere to the mother's womb in somewhere around day 14. So this is day 4 to 6. They remove this trophectoderm, and then these cells here are called embryonic stem cells. Now, what's important about them is that the DNA there can produce absolutely any tissue in the body. Not only that, they're immortal. That is to say, as long as they have nutrients, they will live forever. Or that they won't live forever, they will replicate themselves forever. So what we do is we pull them down here, we put them on a feeder tray, and provide them with nutrients, and then they can make any tissue in the body. And so what the researchers are hoping to do right now is to experiment with these stem cells to turn on just the kind of tissue that they want. Now, in one laboratory that I visited in recent months, they had taken stem cells, and they were trying to develop heart muscle. And in under the microscope, I could see the heart muscle beating, so that they had successfully created heart muscle tissue with this particular method. And I asked the geneticist, well, how is it that you turned on just the genes for heart muscle and you didn't turn on for fingernails or what have you? And she said, we don't really know. I was expecting some, you know, highfalutin technical thing. We don't really know because we're just experimenting. Well, I said, you must have done something because we got this heart tissue. She says, well, what we did was we just fed the culture the kinds of nutrients that we think heart tissue relies upon, and all of a sudden, bang, the cells started working together as heart tissue. And she said, another big mystery here is that we can't really just turn on the genes of an individual cell because the cells work in community. They communicate with each other. And I said, do you mean if I were to take a strange cell and just drop it in the middle of this culture, that it would communicate with the other cells in this culture and become heart tissue? And she said, yes, that's right. So there's just these fascinating little mysteries going on here in all of this research. So we're a long way from getting there, but what we need to know is, where is it that the stuff? But we've got hangovers from the previous arguments. What is the moral status of the blastocyst here that is going to be taken apart and used for this purpose? Is that a human person? Well, to the extent that the Conference of National Catholic Bishops in this country has gotten into the controversy, they want to say, yes, it is. It is a human person. And therefore, this kind of research and experimentation ought not to be done. I find that I think it's a little more complicated than that. I can see why, and actually I admire the Vatican very much, because more than any other Christian group, they've done thinking about these things. But it just seems to me that many of the principles in Vatican bioethics have to be reassessed here. What's so important in natural law theory, as the Vatican applies it here, is that things happen naturally. And for the Vatican, that means that you have a mommy and daddy that has sexual intercourse in the old-fashioned way, and that God participates in that, in the creation of an embryo. You don't have that here. Now, maybe it's immoral to fertilized ova, but the fertilized ova currently exist. And in the laboratory, and these ova will never appear, for practical reasons, not ontological reasons, these ova will never appear in a mother's womb. The ethical question is, does that open up then a kind of moral space in which fertilized ova could be used, pressed into the service of very significant scientific experimentation that might lead to an enormous leap in the improvement of human health? Now, it just seems to me that whatever ethical deliberation we get into, we're going to have to do that. It seems to me that we're going to have a high level of respect. This is not just another piece of protoplasm that we're dealing with, to be sure. Yet at the same time, are we in one of those kinds of situations where it's going to be shades of gray and not black and white, and that the black and white could actually lead us, black and white thinking could actually lead us to unethical behavior in one fashion or another? That's what Francis Collins would argue. Okay, so that's one issue. If you're reading these kinds of articles, that's one issue that's very important. A second and related one, a little bit more technical, and that is, should embryos be created for knowing that they will be destroyed in the process of research? This particular technology does not require the creation of embryos for destruction and research. Others are likely to, and we're going to have similar kinds of arguments. Currently, the National Bioethics Advisory Commission, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, have come out with statements encouraging the continuation of this kind of research. Not only that, that it should be supported by the government. Up until this point, all of this research has been private, and now you might see government funding for it. Okay, that's all by way of background as to what's going on in the research. Let's try the next slide. Next slide. Well, now let me change gears a little bit and kick it up to the level of culture. And I'm suddenly becoming aware of my time. I have 5 minutes before 10. I guess we quit at 10:30. And I do want to leave time for discussion. So let me talk about the question of genetic determinism and human freedom in light of the gene myth And let me tell you what I mean by myth. By myth, I mean a cultural form, a gestalt, a way of thinking that becomes a filter through which we interpret new information or new events. I think that what happens in the laboratory that the geneticists are doing is one thing, and the way it gets reported in the newspapers and the way it gets transmuted into Saturday morning cartoons and into Hollywood movies is another. And it's the gene myth is what you and I are most likely going to confront on a regular basis. And the gene myth says it's all in the genes. The gene myth is very deterministic, much more deterministic than the molecular biologists who are in the laboratory, who tend to be less deterministic than the gene myth. Okay, so the gene myth is a cultural form, but you and I as preachers and teachers and as interpreters of our culture have to deal with the gene myth, and we need to understand it. So let me try the next slide, and I want to say there are three components to the gene myth. And the first one is what I call puppet determinism. That's the belief, rightly or wrongly, it's the belief that the DNA is like a puppeteer and that you and I are puppets and that we dance on the strings of the puppeteer. All right, this is Life magazine from a year ago April. Cover story, you get this DNA symbol here. Were you born that way? Now, if you don't read anything else, I mean, it just reeks of determinism, right? The way I was born determines the way I am. Now, personality, temperament, even life choices, new studies show it's mostly in their genes. Really? One of the geneticists with whom we work, Mary Claire King, who's a specialist in breast cancer, she's the one that named the breast cancer gene on chromosome number 17. And those of you who've been following this know that she named it BRCA1. BR for breast and CA for cancer. But if you read it rightly, BR is for Berkeley and CA is for California, which is where she named it. Anyway, so Mary Clark King looks at this. Actually, I showed this to her. She just laughed. This is crazy. Personality, temperament, life choices, new study is mostly in your greens. Aggression, anxiety, obesity, addiction, optimism. The molecular biologists say they do not have that kind of genetic knowledge to say those kinds of things. Be that as it may, this is the picture that we have growing, that the genes, the DNA, is the puppeteer, and we dance on its strings. Next slide. My genes made me do it. Will we find in court people accused of crime saying, "Don't blame me, Your Honor. I didn't do it. My genes are responsible." My favorite case on this, I'll tell you right now, I was going to do alcoholism later. My favorite case on this is Baker versus the state of California. And let me just back up a little bit. In the late 1980s, a psychiatrist and geneticist named Cloninger thought he had found the gene for type 2 alcoholism on chromosome 21. Now, there seem to be two types of alcoholism. Type 1 would be a person who likes drinking wine, beer, whiskey, or what have you, and over a long period of time, 30, 40 years, just gets in a habit that cannot be broken. That's type 1 alcoholism. Type 2 alcoholism usually starts with a younger person between the ages of 18 and 25, starts drinking and immediately drinks to drunkenness, will do it repeatedly, that this drunkenness will begin to have an effect on his lifestyle. In most cases, it's men, 9 out of 10 type 2 alcoholics are men. And might lead to petty crime, it might lead to inability to hold a job, beating a wife, abusing the children, in and out of jail. And it's fair to ask, could type 2 alcoholism have a genetic component? Cloninger said yes, right there, chromosome 21. And so he published his results, and I want to say that subsequent experimentation could not confirm this. And so we lost this, that it is not due, type 2 alcoholism is not due to a gene on chromosome 21, but you can imagine that research is going to continue and they may find it. Well, in the meantime, Mr. Baker, who is on trial in California for embezzlement, knows about Dr. Cloninger's studies. He's a lawyer, Mr. Baker is, and he's accused of stealing money from his clients. Now, I hope that's not too shocking for you to hear that a lawyer might be accused of embezzlement. And Mr. Baker said to the state of California, "Yes, I took the money, but it's not my fault. You see, I'm an alcoholic. And alcoholism is due to a genetic predisposition, and I stole the money under the influence of alcohol. Therefore, I am innocent. You can blame my gene on chromosome 21. Well, what the court did, I think, is interesting. They said, on the one hand, Mr. Baker, we're sorry that you have the gene for alcoholism that led you to steal this money, but you're still guilty. But we're not going to give you a sentence. We're not going to punish you for this. What we want you to do, Mr. Baker, is go back and stop drinking and to get your life under control. And if you ever show up in this court again accused of the same crime, we'll throw the book at you. So note the assumption of the court is, even though Mr. Baker is genetically determined, the court ceded that, Mr. Baker is assumed by the court to have the power to control that gene's influence in his life. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but these are the kinds of battles over puppet determinism that we're going to have to face in our society. Next slide. Now, the first plank in the platform of the gene myth is puppet determinism. The second one is Promethean determinism. And in the case of Promethean determinism, as you see reflected here in this University of Notre Dame poster, controlling our destinies. Will it be possible to ask our geneticists to get into our DNA with wrenches and screwdrivers and hammers and reshape our DNA so that we can take control of our evolutionary future? Could it turn out that we will be in the driver's seat for determining the genetic makeup of future generations? Now, that's Promethean determinism. In this case, we take puppet determinism, we get control of it, and then we press it into the service of human ends. Promethean determinism has a positive and a negative side to it, as you're probably aware. The word Prometheus means what? Pro and mathine, to think ahead, towards the future. So Promethean thinking is future-oriented, and you can see how the Enlightenment doctrine of progress is now influencing the way we think about the potential for genetic research. But there's a flip side to Prometheanism, of course, and that's the thou shalt not play God part of it. Let's try the next slide. Children made to order. This would be the combination of puppet determinism and Promethean determinism that will create a whole generation of perfect children, genetically perfect, that is. Next slide. Let me get back to the myth of Prometheus and remind you of how it goes. While the world is being created, it's dark. And Prometheus, thinking ahead, can anticipate, wouldn't it be great looking up at the sun and seeing how the gods in heaven on the top of Mount Olympus have access to the sun? Wouldn't it be great if we could have fire from the sun down here in the dark earth, and we could make fires in our fireplaces to get warmth? We could light our candles. We could even light oil lamps and stay up late at night reading volume 3 of Dr. Pannenberg's Systematic Theology. That's how far ahead Prometheus was thinking. And so Prometheus sneaks up into heaven with his torch, and he lights it on the sun, and then he brings his lit torch back to Earth, and he lights candles and fireplaces and things like that, and everybody's happy, except Zeus. Zeus is angry because Prometheus has outsmarted the gods. He has stolen something that belongs only to the gods, fire and light. And so he punishes Prometheus for going beyond the limits of the mortals and entering the realm of the immortals, and ties Prometheus to a rock, and every day an eagle comes to feed on his liver. And I've never figured out the symbolism of that part of the story, even though I think I understand the first part. Now, the Prometheus story is actually a doublet. It gets told a second time. Prometheus has a younger brother named Epimetheus, right? EPI means afterthought. And Epimetheus, according to the story, is a little slow-witted. And Prometheus says to Epimetheus, you know, I think Zeus is pretty ticked off at me. So whatever you do, don't accept any gifts that Zeus might send your way. Okay, brother, says Epimetheus. Then Zeus sends into Epimetheus' neighborhood a beautiful woman. Does anybody remember her name? Pandora. Let's try the next slide. And Epimetheus doesn't pause for a moment. He marries Pandora, takes him into his house where the big box is kept. And Pandora, out of curiosity, opens the box, and out comes flying all of the evils of the world, including all of the human diseases. And she slams the lid back down on the box, and there's only one thing left in there, and what's that? Hope. Well, the point of the story is that even though we have a temptation to transgress our finite limits and enter the realm of the holy, the sacred, or the gods, even though we have that temptation, we should resist it because the gods are going to retaliate and they're really going to punish us, which then leads to the third plank in the gene myth. And let's try the next slide. Thou shalt not play God. And I think that the religious yuck that we experienced during the cloning controversy when it came to articulation was we shouldn't be playing God. That somehow or other DNA is a realm that is sacred, it's holy, and if we get in there, we can only mess things up for the human race. Let's try the next slide. I think this plugs into what the Frankenstein syndrome. At work in our culture, as new technologies come online, we worry that somehow or other either God is going to fight back, or if you don't believe in God, nature. In the case of Frankenstein, it was electricity, bridging life and death with electricity. The contemporary version is Jurassic Park, but now it's genetics, and nature fights back, right, with all of the chaos and the evil of Jurassic Park. I think that the gene myth, on the one hand, is deterministic, but on the other hand, it just plugs into a whole lot of anxiety that we have. And if we're going to respond theologically and ethically, we need somehow or other to recognize that that's what it is that we're responding to, as much, if not more, than what's actually going on in the laboratory. Let's try the next slide. Oh, I'm just going to repeat this. Maybe concerned about time. Let's go on to violence and original sin here. Next slide. Biology of violence. Now, the thought is, could human violence be genetically determined? 1993, there was an experiment in Holland in which geneticists found in a consanguine family of 35 people, seven who shared a genetic configuration that led to a violent behavior, petty crime, voyeurism, in and out of prison, and that kind of thing. And this was due to a specific genetic configuration on the X chromosome. Now, is it likely that we're going to find a gene or set of genes for human sinful behavior or human antisocial behavior? And if that's the case, could we come up with genetic therapies that would eliminate sin from the world? My answer is probably not, that we've got a few conceptual problems here. And with the exception of the kind of thing that I mentioned in this Netherlands study, molecular biologists, who are the ones who deal on the bench and in the petri dishes with the chemicals of DNA, do not have those kinds of genes in isolation. There are three kinds of genetics, and you need to be able to distinguish them when you're reading, because if you can't, you're liable to get off track. There's molecular biology, which is what I've been talking about up until this point, the actual experimentation physically with DNA. The second kind of genetics is behavioral genetics, and those are statistical studies that try to correlate certain forms of human behavior with family trees. These are the ones that deal with twins, especially twins raised apart. They've been raised apart for 30 years, and they both marry a woman named Mary and drink Budweiser. And we get amazed at the genetic predisposition here. What I find interesting is that if genetics really are deterministic, that all the differences between those twins become more significant than what is in common. Behavioral genetics is interesting and it's controversial, but in itself it must be distinguished from molecular biology. The third area is sociobiology, otherwise called evolutionary psychology. And in my judgment, and I just have to give my judgment, this is not science at all, it's philosophy. And it's an attempt to explain all human behavior in terms of evolutionary biology and genetic predetermination. And the argument is essentially that the genes themselves are selfish, that the genes themselves are trying to do one and only one thing, perpetuate themselves from generation after generation, and that this is really the driving force in human evolution, and that all human culture, and even what goes on in our psyches, is reduced finally to these genetic determinants. So when you read an article such as those you find in Time Magazine or New Yorker about the biology of violence or genetic determinism, look at the author's name. Is this a molecular biologist, a behavioral geneticist, or a sociobiologist? And I think you're going to find in almost all cases they're sociobiologists. And that's the case here for this article and others. And please note that, at least in my interpretation, sociobiology is miles away from what's going on in the laboratory. Next slide. Okay. Here we have violence. Hey, it wasn't me, it was my genes. Experts now say that most antisocial behavior, smoking, alcoholism, drug abuse, violence, even criminality can be traced to faulty genes. It's important news. We're not responsible anymore. We're all victims. And then we have camaraderie and we go back to violence. I don't know as though this kind of genetic theory or genetic knowledge is going to really in itself change human behavior. John, what are you thinking about time? It's quarter after. Should
I think we better stop for some questions.
Okay, let me just make some summary remarks and then open it up for questions. On the question of determinism per se, we are, thank you for turning up the lights, and you can turn the slides off. We're in a period where genetic determinism is on the ascendancy, culturally speaking. The environmental determinists, those are the ones who were dominant after the Second World War, you know, how you raise your kid ought to really make you nervous because you might. we have battles now between genetic determinism and environmental determinism, and the way it's going to settle out is that we're going to end up with a two-part determinism, genes plus environment. This is going to become the dominant view. I find that inadequate, because whether it's one-part determinism or two-part determinism, we still don't have any freedom. And yet, your and my daily experience is that we're free human beings. And so if the scientists are going to come along and tell us that that's not the case, they need a lot of evidence. And that evidence is not there. I prefer the model of a three-part determinism: genes, environment, and the human self. What you and I experience on a day-to-day basis is we are human selves, we make decisions, we take actions, and there are consequences to those actions. Human freedom is part of our experience. It occurs at the level of the self. It does not occur at the level of the gene. It does not occur at the level of how our mothers raised us or what kind of food we've eaten. It occurs at the level of the human self. So I want to argue a three-part determinism makes a lot more sense than a one-part or a two-part determinism. Finally, I think that, and this is a thing I would like to say more about, but don't have time, is that it may look like genetic determinism will bring back original sin in the sense that we're born with a propensity to do bad things. And even if it does do that, I think what we need to do when thinking about original sin is say, you know, that's really not what we meant by original sin. What we meant by original sin is that we and the human race are all bound together in Adam, in alienation from God, and we are all bound together in Christ, in God's grace. That's that double dimension. And that understanding of original sin and grace, they go together. You can't have sin without grace. And that's something that's prior to our behavior. Oh, our behavior is very important. But that understanding of sin and grace is something that happens prior to finding out whether we're violent, nonviolent, or what have you. Anyway, those are my my remarks, and now we'll open the floor for question and discussion.
You want to feel? You can feel.
We'll have only 10 minutes for questions. Keep in mind that the dialogue tonight will follow this stuff from both his presentation and Barbara's presentation after a while. There's a question there.
Yeah, I forgot to respond to the question about how old Dolly is. What they did with the development of the telomerase theory of aging, then they went back this February and they measured Dolly's telomeres to try to figure out whether Dolly was born at age 7 or not. I talked with a researcher who did the measuring, who said that the conclusion was inconclusive. It looks like, from this first measurement, that her telomeres are actually shorter than they should be, which suggests that Dolly probably was born at age 7, or somewhere in between. He also said, the researcher that did the experiment, that this either means the telomerase theory of aging is wrong. Oh, I'm sorry, the other piece of evidence is this, is that where they expected to see aging in Dolly's body, they didn't see it. So that on the one hand, the telomeres were somewhat shorter, but on the other hand, she didn't seem to be aging. So from his point of view, they just need to do more experiments before they're sure exactly how this is going to turn out. From the newspaper's point of view, of course, it was spread all over that Dolly was born at the age of 7. You know, and there's some truth to that, but what that doesn't reflect is that the scientists are still in the middle of this, and they really are still trying to sort it out.